Hi, I'm Helena Cobbin, the founder and CEO of Just World Books. Our website is www.justworldbooks.com. We've had a lot going on this spring, including that Gareth Porter, the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, made a short visit to Northern California at the beginning of April. While he was there, Gareth gave a great book talk at the Berkeley Fellowship Unitarian Universalist. We're very grateful that the hosts there, who are from the BFUU's Social Justice Committee, recorded audio of the talk, and they're letting us share the audio on our podcast series. You can find out more about the committee at www.bfuu.org/events/social-justice. The first voice you'll hear on this recording is that of Mickey Huff, the head of Project Censored. Project Censored also co-sponsored that book talk. So at the beginning of the recording, Mickey is introducing Gareth. Then Gareth talks for around 30 minutes. And after that, there's a fascinating question and answer section with the audience. One last reminder before we take you to Berkeley, California. Gareth Porter's book, Manufactured Crisis, is available from our website, www.justworldbooks.com, or from any large online retailer. Thank you, and now over to Mickey Huff in Berkeley.
Greetings, everybody. Thanks to Vic, thanks to Cynthia, thanks to everybody at the BFUU and the Social Justice Committee. Thanks to all of you for coming. Looks like a nice diverse crowd. It's nice to see people from all walks of life, ages, etc. at events like this, especially given the topic and the significance of the topic and how far outreaching it really is. When I lived in Berkeley, I used to run a monthly lecture series here. I used to do a lot of events at the BFUU. So on behalf of Project Censored and the Media Freedom Foundation, I wanted to thank everybody at the BFUU for having us back. And we're looking forward to doing some more events in the near future. So thank you. Cell phones off. That's what you're asking. Turn your cell phones off. Okay, got it. You started doing this, and I'm flashback to church. But this is a different place, but caught me off guard. At any rate, I wanted to call attention to. Well, I'm obviously going to call attention to our illustrious speaker. We're really fortunate to have a scholar and a humanitarian, the magnitude of Dr. Gareth Porter. Coming through town, even though Berkeley is inundated with various people all the time that do a lot of things. We haven't seen Gareth Porter for a while, so it's nice to see you back in the Bay Area, all the way from Virginia. And I'm going to introduce Gareth here, who's going to talk about his new book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And I really resonate with the subtitle of Gareth's book because one of his stories last year was story number 11 as one of the top censored stories of the year, and that was the untold story of the Iran nuclear scare. Little did I know a couple of months ago that Gareth had finished an entire book on the matter, and that's how we started speaking. I'd like to certainly thank Helena at Just World Books as well, and everybody in the Bay Area for making that happen, certainly Henry Knorr as well. Gareth Porter is an investigative journalist and writer on U.S. foreign and military policy. He's written four previous books, including Perils of Dominance and Balance of Power and The Road to War in Vietnam. His journalism has been published in The Nation, Interpress Service, Truthout, and elsewhere in 2012. He was awarded the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Investigative Journalism from the Frontline Club in London, all prestigious. And the accolades for his new book include Cy Hirsch, Juan Cole, Oliver Stone, and Peter Kuznick. And he was on our show, the Project Censored Show, this morning, every Friday, 8 o'clock. We air on KPFA, and Gareth was a guest this morning to sort of give us a little background on this, and he's going to continue to do that right now. And Just before I'm going to welcome Dr. Gareth Porter, I wanted to say that I think it's very important that in the era of technology, where we can beam images places and we can Skype into events and you can see people on YouTube and Facebook and all the other NSA tracked devices and systems. But I think it's really important that we see people together, and instead of doing Facebook, we can get some FaceTime. And that's why I wanted to really especially give a warm welcome to Dr. Gareth Porter, who's come out here from the East Coast. So we'd like to welcome him in person for the important things he'd like to talk about. Welcome, Gareth Porter.
Thank you, Dr. Thanks very much, Mickey, and thank you for your enormous service in helping to bring me to the Bay Area to make it possible. I have a memory of being in this place before. It was 2008, and I know that there's one person in this room who was here that night. But just to recall the scene when I previously appeared in this room, it was a time when the New York Times had published an article which made it look like the Israelis were fixing to attack Iran. And that created quite a war scare, to the point where I was personally convinced that this was a very serious threat. And I can tell you that since 2005, I have been one of the analysts who had been following the Iran issue, the Iran nuclear issue, who did not respond like Pavlov's dog every time there was a commentary or a story in the news media that suggested that Israel was thinking about attacking Iran, or that the Bush administration, particularly Vice President Dick Cheney, was planning to attack Iran. In fact, I tended to think that that was not in the offing, although in 2007, we do know that Dick Cheney, you know, had a plan, had a proposal specifically on the table in the Bush administration to retaliate against some incident in Iraq that could be blamed on the Iranians that would result in the fatalities to U.S. troops. But that, of course, was quickly swallowed up, sat on by the Pentagon and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So what I'm trying to suggest to you is that I was really a skeptic about much of the reporting and commentary that was alarmist about the imminence of a war against Iran. But in 2008, I was convinced this was something that was very serious. And so I did, in fact, come to Berkeley and spoke in this hall about that threat, about that danger of war with Iran. We now know, and this is one of the things that I talk about in my book, that this was only one small chapter, not a small chapter, but only one of many chapters in the saga of Israel's long-running deception of the world with regard to their policy toward Iran, a deception which took the form of essentially letting it be known that Israel might have to attack Iran unless certain things happened. In other words, unless the Iranian nuclear problem was taken care of by the international community. And so I have an entire chapter devoted to what I call phony war crises. And this 2008 war crisis is one of those that I now am able to report and explain in a way that shows that what was really going on was that Israel, the Netanyahu, well, it was not the Netanyahu government, it was the government of Ehud Olmert in Israel, was playing a trick on international opinion by having a major military operation, a military exercise, which went all the way from Israel to the Mediterranean, and which in so doing simulated the path of Israeli jet fighters, jet bombers, which would be able to drop bombs on Iran. And the whole point of it was, in fact, to alarm Western opinion and to stimulate the United States opinion and European opinion, as well as Russian and Chinese opinion, to take a stronger stand against Iran, to get tough on the Iranian nuclear program. And so this is just one of the elements of a much larger picture, which my book covers, of a massive disinformation campaign which has been running for many years, and which, I must say, is a textbook case of how to deceive the American public and the publics of the rest of the world. It is a phenomenally successful effort to essentially fool the entire world with regard to the nature of the nuclear program of Iran. And I think that what we can learn from this description and analysis of the campaign that was carried out by Israel, as well as the neoconservatives in the Bush administration, starting in 2003 and running really up to the present time, is very valuable in understanding just how far and how successful a disinformation campaign can go in creating a false history, a false narrative about a particular issue. And of course, all of you know perfectly well that there is a precedent for the kind of disinformation campaign that I describe in my book, and that is the disinformation campaign that preceded the war in Iraq. And in my book, I try to show point by point the way in which there's an eerie resemblance, in fact, a very strong parallelism between the campaign that was carried out in advance of the Iraq War and the campaign that was carried out beginning in 2003 and continuing for years thereafter with regard to the Iran nuclear program, with the intention from the beginning of laying the political groundwork for war on Iran. So this is really the second time that the neoconservatives within the Bush administration, this time with the active collaboration of the Israelis, specifically the International Intelligence Agency of Israel, Mossad, which played the central role, really, in the plot. This was the second time that there was a very carefully laid out plan to create a false intelligence dossier, a false intelligence case for war against an adversary of the United States. And the parallelism between the two is something that I think is really quite remarkable, because you have in both cases a false document or false intelligence which was at the center of the case for war. In the case of Iraq, we know, of course, that the famous mobile bioweapons laboratories were talked about by Colin Powell at his United Nations speech, in his United Nations speech in 2003. This was the centerpiece of the intelligence case, which he laid out in great detail before the United Nations Security Council. And so the mobile bioweapons labs that Colin Powell talked about, of course, came from reporting from an Iraqi source who was residing in Germany. He was telling these tales to the German intelligence agency, the BND, the German BND officers who debriefed him several times, soon began to wonder whether this could really be true, because things didn't really quite add up. And the more they talked to him, the more they realized that he was simply lying, that it was all a complete fabulation. And they, of course, reported that fact to their senior officials at the BND. And in 2002, when the then director of the Central Intelligence Agency, George Tenet, asked the head of the BND, could we use the information that you've gotten from this source that you had debriefed for public information? And, of course, the director of the BND wrote back and said, not really. You know, you should not use this information. It has not been confirmed, and you should not use it unless and until you can confirm it. And, of course, George Tenet paid no attention because he was in on the war plot of the Bush administration, and so they were simply going to use whatever information they could get to make the case for war. Well, in 2004, when the Iran plot, the Iran disinformation campaign had begun, the BND called in a senior foreign ministry official, foreign office official of Germany, and complained about the fact that Colin Powell had publicly talked about information from intelligence that the United States had recently gotten, which showed that Iran was working very hard on combining their Shahab-3 mid-range missile with a nuclear weapon. And the senior BND officials told this German Foreign Office official that they knew all about this information because it had come from one of their sources. And their source was, in fact, a member of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, Mujahideen-e-Khalq being an Iranian terrorist organization, which had, in fact, killed American civilians as well as military officers in Iran when they were opposing the regime of the Shah in the 1970s. And then after the Shah was overthrown, they carried out terrorist bombings against the Iranian government. And then they were expelled from Iran, and they moved to Iraq, became Saddam Hussein's instruments to use against Iran during that war. And then finally, after that war was over, they moved on to Israel and became the policy tools of Israeli Mossad. So this was an organization which certainly had no credibility as a source for information, no more credibility than the source for the mobile bioweapons labs. And if you recall anything about the history of the run-up to the Iraq War, you may remember the name Curveball. Curveball was the Iraqi source who the BND had debriefed and whose information was then used by Colin Powell before the United Nations. So we have this remarkable set of parallels between the making of a false intelligence case to prepare the ground politically in the United States for war with Iraq and the creation of a false intelligence dossier, in this case with the contribution of the Israeli Mossad intelligence agency for a case for war with Iran. And we now know that that war never occurred. There was never any war with Iran, but the major reason that that's true is that the war against Iraq did not succeed. The Iraqi resistance was so successful that the U.S. military was unable to consolidate its control over Iraq, and as a result, the planned campaign to carry out regime change in Iran through the U.S. military force was continually put off and ultimately had to be dropped because the U.S. never was able to control Iraq in the way that it planned to. So we are indeed fortunate, and we should pay tribute to the Iraqi resistance to the U.S. military, that in fact there was not a war against Iran, which was essentially the plan of the neoconservatives, again in cooperation with Israel, in 2002, 2003, 2004, and beyond. This was indeed one of the breaks that Americans got, because had the Iraq war succeeded, then we would have been in much more serious trouble. So this is really at the center of my book, the story that I tell about the creation of this false narrative, a real second war conspiracy, which was hatched within the Bush administration, but by the way, was never officially the policy of the Bush White House. The proposal that had been made by the neoconservatives in the Bush administration took the form of a long memorandum written by Douglas Feith within the Pentagon and submitted by Donald Rumsfeld, then Secretary of Defense, to the White House for approval to become the U.S. policy. And that proposal was to carry out regime change in five different Middle Eastern countries. Iraq was to be the first, but it was then to include Syria, it was to include Libya, it was to include Somalia, and then the final and crowning success of this policy of regime change through either military force or the threat of force to move things along was, of course, to be regime change in Iran. And the presumption was that the United States would have to use pretty heavy bombing to accomplish that feat, because the neoconservatives believed that the people would only rise up if they believed that the United States was attacking Iran specifically for regime change. And that meant attacking not just the nuclear program, but attacking major military sites, military targets, as well as economic targets, so that the Iranian regime would be seriously affected by the U.S. military campaign, and the signal would be given to people to rise up. And of course, that was totally unrealistic. That was never going to happen. But that was the vision that animated this whole plan that was put into action. So let me take a couple of minutes to describe the role that Israel played in this, because it is indeed central to the plan that was hatched during the early Bush administration. The Israelis, of course, were more than anyone else in the world motivated to try to carry out regime change through military force, but they didn't want to do it themselves. They wanted the United States to do it for them. That was really the Israeli strategy for not just the Bush administration, but long before the Bush administration. The Israelis had a plan that was to get the United States to move towards a military confrontation with Iran, essentially to threaten the Iranians that unless they stopped their nuclear program completely and gave up enrichment of uranium, that the United States would have to attack Iran. So that was the ultimate aim that animated the Israelis for many years prior to this the hatching of this scheme during the Bush administration. And I show in my book that the Israelis themselves, as I indicated about the 2008 war scare, had a long-standing, sort of a constant policy of suggesting that the Israelis might have to attack Iran unless the international community did something about the Iranian nuclear program. This was, of course, the way in which the Israelis hoped to manipulate the policies of the major actors in the issue of the Iranian nuclear program, particularly the United States, the Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese. And they carried out a constant drumbeat of threats, of implied threats, suggesting that that Iran was an existential threat to Israel, which clearly was not a real perception on the part of the Israeli government. This was a ruse which was used to support this strategy of manipulating the world's powers with regard to their policy toward Iran. And even Bibi Netanyahu, who has in the Western press been portrayed as somehow almost irrational about Iran, to the point where he's ready to carry out a war against Iran, regardless of the risk and the cost to Israel. In fact, I show in my book that Bibi Netanyahu is really quite a cautious politician, and who has a reputation within Israel of being somebody who would never do anything without the okay of the United States. And so he's the last person within the Israeli political sphere who would be likely to carry out that sort of threat. And so really what was happening during the Netanyahu government since 2009, his second administration, has been this continuous raising of this theme in the hope of particularly getting the United States, the Obama administration at that point, to push a confrontation militarily with Iran. And that reached its apogee, the highest point of tension, in 2012. Many of you will remember that during the presidential election campaign in the United States, Netanyahu really worked very hard to try to put President Obama in the position of having to accept the red lines, quote unquote, of the administration of Netanyahu. The primary red line, the one that he really cared about the most, was that Iran must get rid of its nuclear program by a date certain. That was what he really wanted the United States to do. And there was a long, almost two-hour telephone conversation in September of 2012, during the last stage of the presidential election campaign, during which Netanyahu importuned Obama, pushed him very hard, repeatedly, to carry out a policy, to accept a policy of confrontation with Iran, essentially presenting an ultimatum to the Iranian government, which would say, you have until this date in 2013 to cease and desist your enrichment of uranium and to declare that your nuclear program is now at an end, or we will have to attack you. That's what he was demanding that Obama would accept as a U.S. policy toward Iran. Well, there was no possibility that that was going to happen. And that marked really the practical end of the Netanyahu campaign to threaten war against Iran. After that, once in a while, he would raise that issue, but no one really took it very seriously. And in his UN speech, which is commemorated on the cover of my book, where Netanyahu held up his cartoon bomb from the Roadrunner cartoon series, this was, in a way, sort of anticlimactic, because it was clear that he no longer really had any hope of pushing the United States into war with Iran. And in that speech, in fact, he did not even hint at the possibility of an Israeli attack against Iran. So that's a pretty interesting indicator of the reality that the Israeli campaign to try to push the United States into war with Iran was, practically speaking, had reached its endpoint. So coming back then to 2004, 2003, 2004, what the Israelis did to provide the ammunition for this disinformation campaign was to fabricate a set of documents which would show what was purportedly a covert Iranian nuclear weapons program. And the documents added up to nearly 1,000 pages, almost overwhelming number of pages for an intelligence dossier. And the headline document, if you will, in that collection of documents was a set of computer printouts, computer modeling studies that portrayed an effort or series of efforts to revise, to improve, to change the reentry vehicle of the Shahab 3 missile of Iran. This was their longest range missile. This was the missile that would have to be their deterrent to the United States and to Israel. And so what was purportedly being shown here was the Iranians, as Colin Powell said a few months later after these documents surfaced, this was an effort to combine a nuclear weapon with their longer-range missile. And this was the evidence that the Bush administration declared was smoking gun evidence that Iran had a secret nuclear weapons program. And they gave these documents to the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. This was the UN agency whose task is to keep track of the nuclear programs of countries around the world and to make sure that no one is using their expertise, their technology to have a nuclear weapon, to work on a nuclear weapon. And the IAEA is an extremely important part of this whole plot to fool the world, because it has been considered and still is considered by the news media in this country and elsewhere to be an impartial, technical, non-political body that does not favor one side or another, that has no political agenda. And that was, in fact, the truth when Mohammed el-Baradei, the Egyptian, was the director general of the IAEA. And Mohammed el-Baradei actually demonstrated his complete independence of the Bush administration in 2003, in the few weeks before the U.S. invaded Iraq, by testifying before the UN Security Council that the primary document, one of the primary documents that the Bush administration was holding up as evidence that Saddam Hussein's regime had a WMD program, an active program in biological weapons, was the famous Nigergate document, which was supposedly showing that Iraq had gone to Niger and made arrangements to procure uranium from that African state. And what Mohammed el-Baradei said to the UN Security Council was, this is simply not an authentic document. We were able to figure out that it is a fabrication and should not be used to indicate that Iraq, in fact, has an active nuclear weapons program. So, in fact, the IAEA has been essentially exploiting that reputation that it had gained because of Mohammed el-Baradei's independence of the Bush administration on the Iraq issue to try to convince the rest of the world that they were, in fact, impartial on the Iran issue. In fact, the IAEA, by 2008, had become simply a tool of the United States. The United States government was working very closely with the head of the Safeguards Department of the IAEA. And this is documented clearly by the WikiLeaks documents. And this is one of those places where, as I discussed on Mickey Huff's program this morning, that it's become very clear that the Iranians were, well, let me start over again, that the point about the documents that the Israelis had fabricated here and that the IAEA was putting forward was that the head of the IAEA was shown in these documents to have been plotting with the Bush administration to show that Iran was not cooperating with the IAEA, which was not really true. And I document this case in great detail in my book. So, I mean, this is one of the ways in which the news media have essentially supported this disinformation campaign because they never really reported the fact that the IAEA was working hand in hand with the Bush administration. They continued to treat the IAEA as though its reports were somehow a technical, absolutely impartial report on what Iran was doing. And so this is one of the essential elements of this plot to deceive the people of the world. And it still goes on today because the IAEA continued to issue reports, not just in 2008, 2009, but particularly a report in 2011, which represented another set of intelligence documents that they got directly from Israel. In this case, Israel didn't even bother to use a pass-through. They gave them directly to the IAEA. And the IAEA still conceals the fact that those documents that they use to accuse Iran of having had a covert nuclear weapons program came from Israel. Now, you know, that's not about protecting sources and methods. It has no validity whatsoever. It is simply protecting the interests of Israel. Because without knowing the fact that these documents came from Israel, readers of newspapers and watchers of television news really are not going to have any basis for evaluating the kind of reports that they get based on these documents. So this is another way in which the IAEA has played a key role in supporting and abetting this deception. And I think if there's one thing that I'm going to continue to try to do, it is to try to unmask the role of the IAEA. It's really quite disreputable and needs to be exposed. So that is a large part of the reason why this deception that has been so successful has achieved the degree of credibility, has been so unquestioned by the news media, by observers outside the government. I have to tell you that up to now, I think I'm really the only person in the world who has challenged this narrative. And I think that that's a remarkable tribute to the demonic success that the people who dreamed up this scheme have had. I would almost be willing to say this is an unprecedentedly successful deception campaign. And may, in fact, be viewed as a kind of model for the future and something that is worth studying if for no other reason, because it does give you a sense of how this is done in the modern world using the tools that are available. So there's a lot more to say, but I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to invite your questions and discussion. please feel free to ask questions, whatever you want. Yeah, please. Microphone.
So if anybody has questions, could you please come up here and line up toward the mic for the purposes of the video? Because otherwise, nothing will get picked up and other people in the room won't be able to hear the questions and comments. So if you could please do that at this time, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Well, I think that most of the news that I've heard by NPR and other supposedly objective news sources is that the IAEA consistently says that, well, maybe Iran had a weapons program, but they ceased it in 2003. That's the story I keep hearing. What is it that you are saying that the IAEA has falsely asserted?
Well, first of all, the IAEA began in 2008 to publish reports which said that these documents showing that Iran had a nuclear weapons program 2001 to 2003 were credible. That's the term they used. They used the term credible. That was chosen deliberately because the IAEA certainly did not know that they were authentic. They never made any effort to authenticate these documents. And using that term was part of the deception that they were practicing because they were really sort of embracing these documents politically without having any objective basis for saying that they were indeed credible. They were, in other words, taking a political position. And to be more specific, it was the Safeguards Department of the IAEA which was taking that position. In 2008, Mohammed El-Baradei was still the Director General of the IAEA. And El-Baradei, every chance he got, emphasized that these documents have not been authenticated. They should not be relied upon until they are authenticated, and we cannot take the position that they're authentic. Unfortunately, in 2008, there was an important political shift taking place, and the Director General was no longer fully in control of the reports that were being issued in his name. The director of the Safeguards Department was essentially dictating the, not completely, but dominating the reports that were being issued on Iran. So that's the first point I want to make. The second point is that the IAEA continues to assert that Iran may have carried out nuclear weapons work after 2003 because at least one of the documents that the Israelis passed on to the IAEA starting in 2008, in fact, was trying to suggest that the Iranians did work on nuclear weapons after 2003. This was a document which had to do with something called a neutron trigger. And I won't go into the, you know, what that means, but the point I want to make is that that document was leaked 2 weeks after Mohammed El-Baradei left the IAEA. It was replaced by Yukiya Amano, a man who had made a deal with the United States, as revealed by the WikiLeaks documents, in 2009 to get the U.S. support to replace El-Baradei in return for assuring the United States that he would support the U.S. position on how to deal with Iran. So I think those are the key things that I would say indicate that the IAEA was making claims that were highly political.
Do you believe, I have two questions. Do you believe the powers that be in the United States have any concept of Middle Eastern history?
Boy, if that's not a softball, I don't know what is. I think the answer to that is clearly no. I mean, there is very little sense of history that can be detected in the actual policy of the United States. I'm not suggesting that there's no one in the U.S. government who has any knowledge of Middle Eastern history, because that would be false. but the people who have a knowledge of Middle Eastern history in the State Department, let's say, are not the ones who are really making that policy decision. The policy decisions, I would suggest to you with very strong conviction, almost always and almost inevitably reflect not the realities on the ground in the Middle East, much less the implications of the history of current events in the Middle East, but rather reflect the domestic politics of the United States, both domestic politics in the sense of reflecting the power of the Israeli lobby in Washington to shape, first of all, the role of the Congress in policy, which has clearly become much more important over the years with regard to Iran. But secondly, the bureaucratic interests of the national security state in the United States, the Pentagon, the CIA, National Security Agency, and so forth. I think those bureaucracies are so powerful that it's their interests that really, you know, constitute an overhanging influence on the policy of the United States at virtually every issue. Again, I mean, I'm not saying that there are no exceptions to this, but I'm saying that that is the general rule that you can begin with to understand U.S. policy. So the answer is no real understanding of Middle Eastern history really informs U.S. policy, even if there are people who really do have some understanding.
You were talking about a group in Iran, a Mujahideen group that moved to Iraq and then went into Israel. Now,
they weren't in Israel, but they worked with Israel because they were located still in Iraq after the war ended. They were still located physically in Iraq. Yeah.
And Israeli defense was working with them?
The Israeli government had various sorts of arrangements with the Mujahideen-e Khalq, but particularly it would have been Mossad who had the direct contact, worked with them, because one of the major functions that the Mujahideen-e Khalq played with regard to Mossad was to launder intelligence information, which the Israelis wanted to get out, but which they did not want to have attributed to Israel. And so there are a number of occasions where the Mujahideen-e Khalq would make public charges about the Iranian nuclear program, which reflected Israeli information that the Israelis gave them. And the most significant, the most well-known incident was that the Mujahideen-e Khalq revealed in a press conference in 2002 the existence of the Natanz enrichment facility in Iran, the first time that had become known publicly in 2002. And they had the exact map coordinates and the exact dimensions of the facility, which, of course, they did not have the capability to get themselves. They clearly got that from the Israelis. And this is also documented in other sources. What they got wrong, however, was the function of the facility. They called it a fuel fabrication facility rather than a uranium enrichment facility, and that sort of gave away the fact they clearly didn't have their inside sources within Iran to tell them what was really going on. It was coming from outside.
Thank you.
I got a number of questions. The first one is... Hello? Hello? I got a number of questions. One question.
One question at a time, at least. You can get back in line. Yeah.
All right. Isn't it true that there was a number of nuclear power stations that were being built by both the Americans, specifically GE, and a number of German companies that were halted construction once the Shah stepped down? And that program was being continued by the Iranians themselves as part of their fuel enrichment program.
Well, I would formulate it slightly differently. I think you're correct up until the last few words that you said. But certainly there was a nuclear power program that the Shah had begun which was strongly supported by the United States government, as well as, of course, by the U.S. nuclear industry, particularly. And it was a very ambitious program. The Shah was planning to have 23 nuclear power plants. That's a lot of power plants. And that requires an awful lot of enriched uranium. And the plan was for Europe to provide, a European company, a French-based company, to provide that fuel based on enriched uranium. And what happened after the Iranian Islamic Republic government took power was that initially they said, we don't want to have anything to do with this. This is the Shah's toy, the Shah's plaything with his American imperialist friends. And so they really decided they didn't want to continue the nuclear program. But within a short time, within a couple of years, they decided to keep the program in a minimal sort of scope with just Bushehr. And they would depend on the same French company to provide the fuel. They would not enrich uranium. That was not the expectation. That was not the plan. And an essential part of the story, which I tell in my book, is that the United States, instead of saying, okay, well, this is not, there's no threat here. There's no threat of proliferation. We don't have any problem with that. The Reagan administration stepped in and insisted that the Germans not help them complete the Bushehr reactor, and that the French refused to cooperate in providing the fuel for Bushehr. Well, that left the Iranians with a choice. They could either abandon nuclear power completely and bow down to the United States in the process, or they could get their own independent enrichment capability. Well, we can guess pretty easily what the answer that the Iranians would give to that question would be. And of course, they chose the independent enrichment capability. And then the United States government, by that time it was the end of the Bush, George H.W. Bush administration and the beginning of the Clinton administration, then turned around and said, oh, look, that's evidence that Iran wants a nuclear weapon. Oh, and that is the part of the story that, in a sense, provides the basis for the misinformation, disinformation campaign that I've been talking about.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Garrett. This is a single question, a comprehensive nuclear question. So I wonder if you could fill in the blanks for us on the OSIRIS reactor that Israel bombed and the time frame there, the Stuxnet attack, which is in fact an attack, Obama's declared policy that he reserves the right to do cyber attacks, the risk of that to Iran's peaceful nuclear program, and the present Vienna negotiations are being sabotaged by this whole undercurrent, right? Because we're still hearing all of this all the time, camouflage in various ways. So if you could comment on Iran's right to a peaceful program and its risks from these other events.
I'm glad you've highlighted the rights question, because that was really part of the answer to the previous question, which I didn't give, and that is that, of course, when the Reagan administration was using its power over its allies in Europe specifically to try to strangle the Iranian nuclear program in the cradle in the early 1980s, they were violating very clearly and directly the rights of Iran under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That treaty states as clearly as is possible to state that every member of the treaty, every signatory of the treaty, has the right to peaceful uses of nuclear power. And the only thing that is not allowed having to do with nuclear technology is a nuclear to have a nuclear weapon. So unless you have evidence that a signatory of the NPT is in fact working on nuclear weapons or has a nuclear weapon, then there's no legal basis for doing anything to interfere with a peaceful nuclear program. That's exactly what the United States did. And again, it has to be emphasized, the Reagan administration did not only did not have any evidence of an Iranian nuclear weapons program or any intention to have a nuclear weapons program. They didn't even claim that they had any evidence. They didn't claim that there was any Iranian violation of the NPT. They didn't claim that there was any Iranian violation of their safeguards agreement with the IAEA. So it was the most naked use of power by an imperialist state that you can imagine. It was undisguised. Mm-hmm. Normally, an imperialist state uses some sort of excuse. They cook up a case, you know, as they have done in the case that we've been talking about in more recent years. In this case, there was no pretense. They simply said, well, we don't want Iran to have a nuclear program. This was, of course, in the context of the Iran-Iraq war, in which the Reagan administration was supporting Iraq openly not so openly actually providing arms to Iraq. But, you know, it was in that context that they were carrying out the policy, but there was no basis, there was no color of international law that they could cite to justify that. And as far as the cyber war attacks concerned, I think it's a very important thing to understand that this is indeed an act of war. Yeah. It was the first national cyber attack against another country, which resulted in the destruction of property. In this case, it was the destruction of the centrifuges in Natanz enrichment facility. So it was an extremely serious thing to do. And it really beggars the imagination that Obama made the decision to continue this program that the Bush administration had begun. This was already a plan that was had begun under the Bush administration. But within days of Obama's taking office, he was already sitting down with the cyber warfare experts who were working hand in hand with the Israelis, because this was a U.S.-Israeli joint undertaking to plan a cyber offensive against Iran's nuclear program. And so while Obama was articulating the idea that he was committed to diplomatic engagement and thus suggesting that he was really going to carry out a peaceful approach to the problem of Iran's nuclear program, he was in fact carrying out exactly the opposite.
So the Vienna prognosis, and then I'll go see.
Yes,
thanks.
Yes. Well, I mean, to try to summarize my view of the negotiations, I do think that there is a good chance that these negotiations could succeed. The technical issues that are on the table all lend themselves to solutions which would clearly protect the national security interests of both countries, and which would be in the interest of both countries. And both sides could make a case to their respective publics that that is the case. The problem that I see is that the Obama administration lives in a bubble, exists in a bubble, has existed in a bubble since the beginning. And that bubble includes the belief in all of the lies that are part of this disinformation campaign about the Iranian nuclear program. And as a result of that, the Obama administration is peculiarly vulnerable to political attack. Maybe I shouldn't use the word vulnerable. They are susceptible to political attack from the Israeli lobby and others in the right wing of the Republican Party, particularly, and the news media, that they are not protecting American security because, after all, the Iranians want to have nuclear weapons, and therefore we must press them for... I think the potential deal killer here is the demand for a six-month minimum, what they call breakout period. That means that the United States is demanding a combination of concessions by Iran on the number of centrifuges and other issues, which would give the United States 5 months from the time that Iran would make the first move that could be interpreted as moving towards enrichment for a weapons purpose. And that is a completely political notion. It has no technical significance. It has no technical validity whatsoever. It is simply something that they've accepted because they've bought into this notion that Iran really wants nuclear weapons, and therefore they feel that they are bound to give concessions essentially to the Israeli right, the pro-Israeli right in this country. So I think that's really the danger that we face with regard to these negotiations.
I'm wondering if you could share your thoughts about how decisions to conduct regime change are made. And what I mean by that is, you mentioned a memo by Douglas Fife saying that the plan was made to overthrow or regime change for five countries. And you gave the five countries. But Douglas Fife was not elected president of the United States. And right. And presumably he alone would not have the power to write that memo. And so who was making the decision? How did that decision get made?
That's a great question. It's one that I think it's important to understand the distinction that you've just made between the memo by Douglas Fife, which was given to Rumsfeld and passed on to the White House, and the actual policy of the United States. The fact is that memo, which called for regime change in five Middle Eastern countries, including Iran, never became official U.S. policy. It was not accepted by the White House, and within 3 days of the White House decision not to accept it, Rumsfeld turned it into strategic guidance for the Department of Defense for the next 4 years. So it became an official document of the Department of Defense, essentially. Now, that obviously, as you've correctly said, is not U.S. policy. It's not the policy that the President of the United States has endorsed. And so it has very limited application. But the reality within the Bush administration was that the neoconservative group continued to push its agenda while the Colin Powell group and the State Department, which was the only real resistance to the neoconservatives, was pushing a different agenda. And so there was this constant battle going on within the Bush administration for the decision by President Bush. And the neoconservatives had a hole card. They had an ace, which was, of course, Vice President Dick Cheney, who, during this period, had the opportunity to get the last word in to President Bush. And there's no doubt that did make a significant difference. That was one of the factors that certainly played a role in Iraq. The State Department people did not favor the invasion of Iraq. That was something that they knew was a terrible idea. CIA did not favor it. But the neocons prevailed on that, in part because they had their man in the White House there with the president. That didn't always work, but it did work a lot of the time. And, so the reality is that that political infighting continued throughout the Bush administration, and we don't know what the outcome would have been with regard to Iran had the United States been able to consolidate its control over Iraq. Maybe, the president would have decided against it. But we do have testimony, we have evidence from various sources during the Bush period that he was strongly inclined towards regime change in Iran. He did support that. He liked the idea of regime change in Iran. So, there is some strong reason to believe that it really was a serious danger.
Hi. I remember hearing reports in the mainstream media earlier in this century by the previous president of Iran, whose name escapes me at the
Khatami.
Moment.
President Khatami? Ahmadinejad. You mean Ahmadinejad. Yeah, sorry.
I'll characterize as a hostile rhetoric directed towards the state of Israel, or directed about the state of Israel.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if you could comment on that.
Very good question. Something that's very important to discuss for sure. First of all, of course, the reality is that Ahmadinejad was a blessing for the hardliners in Israel, because if Ahmadinejad had not existed, they would have needed to invent Ahmadinejad, because his rhetoric was extremely useful for the Netanyahu administration. And the thing that was most widely publicized that Ahmadinejad said was something to the effect that Israel should pass into the pages of history, should pass from the pages of history. That is the best translation of what Ahmadinejad said in Farsi. It was translated by the New York Times and by other sources as Israel should be wiped off the map, which, of course, conjures up a rather different understanding or image of what the Iranians had in mind. And the Israelis and their supporters in the United States used that mistranslation and the image that presented, the impression that created, to maximum political advantage. They suggested that meant that Iran intended to destroy Israel physically, militarily, and that the nuclear weapon would be the instrument for doing that. There is absolutely no possibility that was the intention of Ahmadinejad in making that statement. I mean, there is zero possibility that was the intention. The Iranian policy toward Israel and Palestine has been reasonably clear over the years. That policy has been to support the rights of the Palestinians in Israel to the point that there should not be a regime in Israel that is a regime that gives the Jews special rights that the Palestinians do not have. It should be a regime that gives equal rights to Palestinians and Jews, and therefore, is not a Jewish state. In other words, they do not support the Jewish state of Israel. They do not recognize and will not give legitimacy to the Jewish state, to the idea that Israel is a Jewish state. And so they do support, in effect, the demands of the Palestinians for full rights. They have not specified that it is for a separate Palestinian state, but they have said that they will support what the Palestinians have decided is the correct resolution to this problem. And so, not that much different from the position that many states, including the United States, had taken towards the regime, the apartheid regime in South Africa. That's not a legitimate structure for a regime. That regime should not continue. It should be changed. And therefore, I think that is a critical piece of disinformation or misinformation that has clearly not only survived but has had huge impact on opinion in this country and around the world.
Yeah. Hi, Garrick. Gareth. I'm hopeful of a nuclear accord between the P5 plus one and Iran over the nuclear program. I'm hopeful for a nuclear accord between the P5 plus one and Iran. Can you speak a bit about the issues of transparency between Iran and the United States and sort of the test of wills over the alleged evidence of that Iran had a new weaponization experimentation between 2001 and 2003, and how this can be resolved in order to go forward for
the
final accord?
Okay, good question. And this allows me to make a point that I haven't made thus far, which is that the disinformation campaign, essentially a war conspiracy that was hatched during the Bush administration about the Iranian nuclear program, is not just a matter of historical interest. it's still a very important consideration, an important factor in the negotiations between the G5 plus one and Iran. And the reason is that the Obama administration has introduced into the phase of the negotiations on a comprehensive settlement the issue of possible military dimensions. That's the phrase that has been used to refer precisely to these falsified documents that the Israelis created and falsified intelligence reports that have been the centerpiece of the campaign and which have been so successful in turning public opinion towards the acceptance of the idea that Iran has had a nuclear weapons program. So the Obama administration has said that there is a phrase, there are a set of phrases in the joint plan of action, which refer simply to a joint commission consisting of the P5 plus one and Iran, which would help to facilitate resolution of concerns. It doesn't describe what sort of concerns, but then, you know, senior officials of the Obama administration briefing the news media have then gone on to say that that means that the Iranians must satisfactorily resolve the issue of possible military dimensions for the IAEA. Now, more recently, there have been statements suggesting that really this is something the IAEA has to resolve. And that raises the question whether the IAEA is in fact going to reach an agreement with Iran on this question of whether these documents really are credible information, credible evidence on the question of Iran's nuclear program, or whether the IAEA will continue to maintain the same thing that it's maintained all along. I mean, you know, this is not clear. This is the question that I would highlight. Whether the IAEA is ready to make an agreement, to reach an agreement with Iran, or whether they're going to continue to play the game that they've played in the past. One of the factors here, of course, is that there was this agreement between Yukiya Amano and the Obama administration, whereby he would do the Americans' bidding and they would support him. And if that's the case, and if the United States does want a deal, maybe he would bend to the American will and make a deal. And that's my hope. That's my hope at this point, that would get rid of that problem. And but of course, I mean, that has implications for a lot of people's interests. Because if the IAEA does make a deal, it implies at least that those documents were not authentic. And that's the difficulty that I think they have to work around somehow. Thank you for that question.
Based on your research in this region and even, you know, before that, Indochina and so on, of U.S. strategic perspectives, in terms of the evolution of U.S. strategy toward the Middle East, we're talking about political, military, economic. Have you seen documents to show that the U.S. shifted at a certain point, for instance, after the OPEC oil increase? I heard some rumblings that Kissinger actually threatened the Saudis about these oil prices and that if they didn't moderate this, the U.S. was going to directly insert itself militarily in the Middle East. And then, of course, the U.S. relied on the Shah of Iran and Israel as sort of the two cops on the beat to maintain right. The interests of the empire. And when the Shah came down, you're down to Israel. So the question is, because there's been a big increase in the number of military, U.S. military bases in that region, in the Middle East and South Asia. Have you come across documents and research showing the U.S. pivoting away from more dependence on client states toward more direct insertion of U.S. military, political, economic power?
Well, I think the answer to that is easy. The answer is yes. Yes, if you're taking a somewhat longer-term perspective, that is, starting with the Bush administration to the present. I mean, the Bush administration's policy represented precisely that sort of development in U.S. policy. It was, in fact, no longer relying on a regional client to sort of maintain stability or order or whatever they wanted to call it in the Middle East, but rather relying on directly on U.S. military power. I mean, the essence of this strategy, basically propounded by Douglas Feith in that memo of September of 2001, September 21st, 2001, was that we are now in a position, the United States is in a position, to use military force to change the map, the political map of the Middle East. And there was this incredibly unrealistic, I would call it fantasist, notion that U.S. military power could indeed accomplish this kind of change, not taking into account the political realities, of course, country by country throughout the Middle East, and particularly not taking into account the political realities within Iraq, the first domino that was supposed to be falling under this strategy. It was a strategy that, you know, unprecedentedly, just without any realistic basis whatsoever. And indeed, you know, I would argue that any strategy that relies on military force has no contact with reality. I mean, it's a sheer fantasy of a policy rather than a policy based on reality. And so I think that is the significance of that shift in the policy that began with the Bush administration in 2001, and that we are still seeing the end of that phase of U.S. policy in the Middle East, with the withdrawal from Iraq, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the decision not to have a war in Syria. It's very clear that the ability of this country to carry out wars, traditional sorts of wars involving bombing and ground troops, or even, you know, sustained use of air power, is coming to an end. I mean, this is not politically feasible in the way that it was a decade or two ago. I mean, you know, this all started in 1991 with the first Gulf War, when, you know, we had this cakewalk of a war that was won very quickly and created the impression in the United States that this was the way you could fight wars in the future in the Middle East. That was, of course, the intention of Dick Cheney as Secretary of Defense at that point, and continued to be the vision that the neoconservatives had in their heads for the next couple of decades. But it's profoundly unrealistic, and I think we are entering an era of profound change, very difficult to predict exactly what form that's going to take. You know, it's an era which is inviting activism, in fact. It's an era which invites the effort by movements for change to intervene and to push things in a particular direction. Unfortunately, of course, as we all know, the movement against militarism in this country has suffered enormous losses over the past decade, and has to be rebuilt from the bottom up, from the ground up. But that's, you know, it's a good time in terms of the geostrategic perspective, the historical perspective, I would argue.
So what's to be done with the Boeing mop, the deep bunker buster? You know the figures better than I do, how much. This was solely for the underground labs. And actually, what you know, what do you think the role of the corporations will be in commanding a future you're talking about?
Okay, well, that's two very, very distinct questions. With regard to the bunker busters, it's true that the biggest of the bunker busters are capable of penetrating pretty deeply into the Iranian nuclear program facilities, And it's been argued, I don't know the answer to this, the technical questions surrounding this, but it's been argued that it may not be able to actually destroy the centrifuges that are buried in the mountain in the Fordu facility in Iran, but that it would be capable of closing the entrances, making it impossible for it to be used. So, assuming for the moment that that's the case, this does represent a threat that the United States could pose militarily to Iran. There's no doubt about that. But I would argue that the politics at this point in the United States of the notion of going to war against Iran at all are so formidable. The resistance, not just popular resistance, we know there would be popular resistance if indeed this was discussed seriously. But more importantly at this moment is the resistance by the Department of Defense itself and the military services. Because very simple fact that Iran can retaliate against U.S. forces in the Middle East. They're very vulnerable. Both the ground bases in the Middle East that the U.S. has maintained and the naval ships going through the very narrow Strait of Hormuz, which is very close to the mainland of Iran, and the Iranians have very effective anti-ship missiles, which they could use. And the U.S. Navy knows that very well. So I think that's the key to the reason that it's very, very unlikely that this is going to come to pass.
We're going to take a brief pause for 30 seconds. The camera person has to change a battery. But I'm also going to announce, take this opportunity to announce, we have two more questions or comments here for Dr. Gareth Porter. We're then going to wrap up this segment, but we are going to remain here in the hall with Dr. Porter over here at the table. His book is for sale. Project Censored's 2014 book is for sale. And you can, of course, not buy them and just look through them and see what's going on with them and certainly talk to Dr. Porter, and I will be over at the table, so let me know when you're ready. You ready? Okay. So we'll continue with these final two questions.
Thank you, Dr. Porter. Just a quick comment. Another question is that I guess this would be the third coup United States does on Iran. First one, 1953. Second one, 1979. Were successful, both of those two. This is the third one that failed. But the question I have in mind, sir, is that Mujahideen, you brought it to my attention. Mujahideen is an Arabic word. It's actually called al-Mujahideen. Al means the. So al-Mujahideen is not a Persian. It's not a Farsi name. Are you saying it? It's a part of Iran? It is a rebel group that a part of Iran organized by Iran or independently in Iran organized? Or is it is organized outside of Iran?
Well, it's always been an unofficial organization. It started as a combination of Marxist and Muslim revolutionary organization against the Shah.
Iranians?
Iranians, yes. And it evolved over time because of conflicts with the other the Islamic forces, trying to overthrow the Shah. They had very major differences politically, and that evolved then into a situation where the Mujahideen Khalq was really carrying out terrorist bombings against civilian gatherings of the Islamic Republic of Iran itself.
And they're opposite with Hezbollah? Mujahideen versus...
Oh, yes, Israel, yes, completely. Absolute enemies, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But they're both from the same country, Iran.
Well, Hezbollah is not Iranian, but they're supported by Iran, yeah.
So, where are they from?
Hezbollah is Lebanese.
Lebanese. Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Hi. Okay, I'm wondering, assuming you're right with your indications and you achieve your goal of this expose of the IAEA, the U.S. government, Israel, and this whole thing, what do you expect to accomplish with it? And let me put that into context so you understand my question. You talked about the last 10 years with the militaristic nature of the country and it taking a big backward step and all. 15, 20 years ago, Clinton's popularity dropped precipitously. So he lobs a couple of missiles over to Africa, blows up a chemical factory, hits the front page, and his popularity jumps 20 points. 6 months later, in the back of the paper, there's a few small articles saying that, oops, it really was a legitimate factory. We made a mistake, and the U.S. is paying reparations to the families of those people killed. His popularity didn't drop 20% again. You really need an informed, intelligent populace doing the electing to be able for your expose to have an effect. So I guess my real question is, how is your expose, or how do you expect or hope that your expose is going to change the country and the world?
Well, that's the most difficult question I've gotten all night, believe me. The most troubling question all night. And the answer is that I don't really expect to change the country, of course. I'm a bit more realistic than that. I mean, for one thing, you know, as well as I do, that the reality is that the structure of the news media in this country is such that it's very, very difficult to get a story based on this sort of account into any corporate news media. I mean, it's very unlikely to happen. I will say that I've tried to do that. I've been working on that. And I've had one nibble of interest, and that was Bloomberg News Service. But that's the only one out of all the people I've contacted with my book and, you know, given them the story and so forth. So far, everybody else has turned it down. They've said that, well, this is old stuff. It's not new. And besides, I'll be honest. I mean, I was trying to get the story of the key documents being turned over to the German intelligence, not by somebody from within this alleged nuclear weapons program, as was the official line, but by the Mujahideen Calc. I thought that was a pretty saleable, if there was a story in the book, that was the most saleable story in it. So that was what I was trying to get somebody in the news media interested in. And Los Angeles Times turned it down, the Wall Street Journal turned it down. I wrote a piece myself for The Guardian. They turned it down. Who else? Well, I've tried op-ed pieces in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Christian Science Monitor, Washington Post. I know, we've got Nikki's outfit. They've published it. So I'm realistic enough to know that it's not very likely that it's going to reach a wider audience. And I think the second part of your question is really the most important part, which is, you know, what do you do to try to change this? What do you do to make Americans more conscious of the way in which they're being deceived, the ways in which they're being deceived? We have to be realistic about this. We are at the end at the end stages of a long process of dumbing down in this country. This audience is, I'm not looking in the right place. I'm looking at you. This is the end, sort of nearing the end of a long process of dumbing down in which the news media and the educational system both have continued to degenerate in terms of the way in which they affect people's ability to understand what's going on in reality. And as a result, we are farther and farther away from any capability in this country to grasp the most essential facts about our national security policy. And given that fact, you know, if you ask me what my political strategy would be, it would be two things. We need to have a very simple, easily grasped slogan, which is the basis for a political campaign. And the slogan would be something along the lines of, don't be a sucker. Don't be a sucker. You are being taken for a sucker by this system. you're being sucked dry by a system which is, you know, using your money to feather their own nests. And in fact, this whole system, which is called the national security state, the whole system of national security policy has nothing to do with national security whatsoever, never has. It's simply a system by which these massive, powerful bureaucracies continue to become more powerful, have more prestige, more ability to manipulate the political system and the politics of this country, and ensure their futures for decades to come. That's the objective. And they're, you know, in some ways they're quite honest about it. It's not particularly a secret, but it is not understood. And so my strategy would focus on that as something that people who, you know, may be of the generation that don't really read books anymore could grasp. And along with that strategy, I would put something in Congress, in the congressional hopper, the queue of legislative proposals. Even though I've given up on Congress, I don't think there's any hope that Congress will be able to do anything for the foreseeable future. I would get a piece of legislation in Congress that would represent a policy, that would state a policy that it is the policy of the United States to eliminate the capability to intervene in countries around the world, to use military force to intervene around the world. You know, to use words to that effect. And use that as a mobilizing tool, as an organizing tool. So I think it's the combination of those two things. Have you know, emphasize that people are being taken for a ride, you know, being taken to the cleaners, I think is a better way to put it, by the national security state, and make that the essence of the issue. And have something to organize around that you can push Congress on and say, if you don't support this, you don't get my vote. Thank you.
Hey, give them more hand of applause. Thank you very much, Gareth Porter. I'll tell you what, he's going to be here hanging out with you and yeah, able to talk and sell books and sign books. His book is called Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of Iran Nuclear Scare, The Iran Nuclear Scare, right over there. Please hang out for a little bit with us.